Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Welcome to Formula Y, the official F1 podcast, all about how F1 works. I'm Christian Hugill.
And I'm Katie Osborne. If this is your first time listening to Formula Y, well, welcome. And if you've listened to every single one of these episodes so far, welcome back.
Yeah, if you're new to Formula Y, it is great to have you on the team. Basically, this podcast answers a why question about F1 every week. We've already explored why F1 Sprint is such a challenge, why the US has three races in 2023, and why F1 drivers need to be so fit. Those episodes are available to listen to now, so check those out.
Now, we usually pick one question and get the answers from a bunch of F1 experts. But this is a slightly different episode. This time, we're going to answer as many of your questions as we can.
And this podcast is just a baby, right? We're only a few episodes old, but already we've had loads of questions emailed into whywhy@f1.com. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. And if you still have a question you'd like us to answer, record it as a voice note. I do dig a good voice note. Or write it in an email and send it to that address, whywhy@f1.com.
That's one thing I've learned from getting to know Katie Osborne over the last few weeks. She loves a voice note, don't you, Katie? Love a voice note.
It's so authentic. It's genuine.
Katie wants your voice note. Yeah, we will answer your whys, your whats, your hows. And we have got a couple of F1 experts to help us do just that. So welcome to our resident F1 race strategist. She's back. Bernie Collins, former Aston Martin head of strategy, and of course, the strategist who helped Sergio Perez get his first F1 win. Hello, Bernie.
Hello, everyone. That's such an introduction. Thank you so much for having me again.
You are most welcome. Welcome back. And welcome to the guy, right, who has the best shoes in the F1 paddock. You've read his articles on F1.com. You've seen him on F1 TV. It is F1 correspondent and presenter Lawrence Barreto. Lawrence, when we first got on this call, the first thing me and Katie said, having met you quite a few times, is, how are the sneakers? How are the shoes? Just for anyone that doesn't know, explain this for us.
Well, thanks very much, firstly, for having me, guys. It's really cool to be here. And yeah, lots of people talk to me about my shoes. I've got 75 pairs of shoes.
75?
Yep.
Wait, hold on. Before we dive into all the things, I'm just curious, how do you know which one to pick out of your closet? Like, having two choices sometimes is hard, let alone 75.
So I've bought them based on races that I'm going to go to. So I already know at the start of the year what shoe goes with which race. And then I take 8 pairs with me and then I rotate them through the weekend.
So you're always a checking your luggage kind of guy.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Like two checked. This is embarrassing. 2 checked in bags.
I love that. I'm heading.
And so,
because also there's the safety option. Like, so if one bag gets lost, I've got the second bag as an option.
Yeah, we can have another podcast on how and why it is to best carry your luggage to all of these races, because I have some questions about this. But anyways.
We need to do a spin-off, don't we? I've got more questions, but we really should talk about Formula One. So Lawrence and Bernie, we are just going to throw these questions at you. They're in no particular order and they're on all sorts of topics, but we've had several sent in about tyres. Our listeners seem to love tyres, so that seems a good place to start. Here is the first question.
Hello, Katie and Christian. Thank you so much for this podcast. My name is Humura Ruth and I am from Uganda. I also love Formula One to the extent that I have a Formula One podcast of my own. But there are things that I don't understand about the sport. So here are my questions. What exactly causes tire lookups? And then how does tire pressure influence performance when it comes to racing? I know that tires are the only parts of a car in F1 that touch the ground. So how does the pressure in those tires actually influence performance? Thank you so much.
Right, should we do lockups first? And let's go to Bernie Collins. Bernie, firstly, what causes tire lockups?
Well, there's a lot of very different reasons that we can have tire lockups. And Lawrence, correct me at some point where I say something that you don't agree with. But, you know, you can have the very standard lap one going into turn one, both of the front tires lock up, and a lot of that is the driver over expectation of how quickly the car can stop. So the car is very heavy, it's very hard to stop at that point. And the reason that we see it more so on the front is because the weight transfers forward under that braking zone. So that just means that the front tire is under a little bit more stress at that point. But there's a whole host of different reasons that it happens. So it might be that the brake balance, so we talk about in a car, you can have more braking performance from the rear or the front. So it might be a little bit too far forwards, which causes a front lockup. Or you could have, particularly in a cornering situation, that the inside or the outside tire doesn't quite have the ability to brake as much as being asked for. And those are the types of things that cause those lockups that we see. And the difficulty with a lockup, obviously, one of the problems is that because that tire is not rotating with the road, you tend to wear away one patch of the tire. So you get this sort of flat spot on the tire then, which is really hard to drive with.
So yeah, I think we see this quite often, like Bernie said, often heading down to the start, to the first corner, often when the track is very green as well. And essentially, when we refer to a lockup is when a tire stops rotating and you just see a lot of smoke. So you'll see the tire just sliding along. You'll see the driver pretty frustrated because at that point they're not turning. They're just going straight on at that point. They want to try and release the brakes as early as they can to try and avoid that flat spot that Bernie was talking about. If they can't do that, then it's more than likely they're going to have to return to the pits and get a fresh set of tires. So lockups generally happen when they just essentially slap on the brakes way too hard, and that's what stops the brake disc rotating.
And it's a bad thing, isn't it? Because what generates speed in a Formula One car through the corners is it's sort of broken up into three, if I'm right in thinking, isn't it, Bernie? Your sort of entrance to the corner, the middle part of the corner, and then your exit, effectively getting your foot down to exit the corner smoothly and as quickly as possible. I'm guessing, Bernie, that if a tyre's locking up on the way in, it's skidding across the surface and not braking as effectively and stopping the car effectively as it could be.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a few problems. You're often, like you say, not stopping the car quickly enough or effectively enough. You often then, like Lawrence mentioned, can't steer enough, even at that very initial part of the corner. So the corner entry that I talk about, there's already some steering angle there. So maybe you can't do that because you're locking up one tyre. And sometimes fundamentally, the drivers end up then slowing the car too much. So in the middle part of the corner, your corner speed's actually too low, and therefore you've lost time all the way through the corner. And again, then on exit, when drivers are trying to put their foot on the throttle to pick up the speed for the next straight, you're starting from too low a corner speed. So you lose time the entire way through the corner just with that lockup. And it really affects the driver's feeling of balance in a corner.
Interesting. My question to that is, can a driver in that moment do anything else to either avoid it or to change the situation, Lawrence?
So they can try, if they've got enough space, if there's runoff at the edge of the corner, then they can release the brakes and then stop and allow the tire to rotate again. But often you'll find that they're probably locking up because they're trying to avoid contact A with another car, B with a wall, with a barrier. So actually at that point, when you're in that scenario and you're sliding, there's not a lot you can do. And then that just obviously causes the issue, the smoke and the flat spot.
And then at that point, that tire pressure, when it starts to decrease, how does that influence the performance?
So tire pressures, generally speaking, teams want to run them, as far as I understand it, and Bernie, you can correct me if I'm wrong, they want to run them as low as possible because that just increases the tire contact patch on the asphalt. And the greater the contact patch, the greater the amount of grip. And Formula One drivers, if you ever talk to them after the race, all they ever want is more grip, because that just means that they could go faster through the corners and they can do a faster lap time. So in an ideal world, teams try to run low tire pressures. That means Pirelli, they set the tire supplier for Formula One, they set the minimum tire pressure so the teams can't go below that. And that's just from a safety perspective. You don't want them to be stressing the tires and putting too much stress on the structure. If you were to run a higher tire pressure, that just means a smaller contact patch. So there's less rubber touching the track. So I think that roughly means that they'll get a little bit more speed down the straights, but the tires are going to be firmer and more responsive. But it also means that you're probably more likely to overheat the tyres, or the tyres will get warmer. And that means you'll probably end up changing them much quicker.
Bernie, you're nodding your head. It sounds like Lawrence's tyre pressure knowledge is good.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And the sort of way to think about it, you know, without the very fundamental understanding of tyres, is if you just think of a balloon, just a normal balloon, the more that that's blowing up, the less the balloon will be in contact with the floor. Whereas if you've got a very flat balloon, so a low tyre pressure, then lots of the surface of the balloon is going to be in contact with the floor. It's exactly the same with the tyres. I think Lawrence has explained it really well there. And, you know, just to touch on his final point, there's a very direct relationship between the heat in the tyre and the pressure that's in there. So for a lower pressure, it will heat up a bit less. For higher pressure, the inside of the tyre will get very, very hot, and that causes some overheating problems that we see.
How does tyre pressure impact when it's wet out there in those kinds of conditions, Bernie?
Yeah, so if you've got, like, generally with wet conditions, it's very dependent where we are in the world, but generally wet comes with very, very cold track temperatures. So a bit more tyre pressure in there, even above what Pirelli state, means that you can get the tyre heated up really, really quickly. But then we see some, you know, other countries where we go to where it's, you know, more monsoon conditions, the track temperature is actually very hot, even though it's wet. So at that stage, you don't want the tyre to heat up really, really quickly. And that's where we see, and, you know, we've had lots of instances in the past where people can almost do the full race on one set of wet tyres, even though the track's drying. And that'll be because the tyre isn't overheating internally. So there's a very, very delicate balance between the pressure that's in the tyre, what sort of stint you're, so how many laps you're trying to achieve with that tyre, and what the actual track temperature and conditions are. So it's really, like, interesting and very knowledgeable bit of engineering, actually. And all of the teams will have a tyre department of three or four people that are just focused on how the tyres are reacting with the car.
So you can use your tyre pressure to either generate grip quicker or potentially help your tyre last longer, depending on the weather, depending on the track temperature, that sort of thing, Bernie.
Yeah, exactly. And we've seen, you know, even in recent races, we hear drivers getting a lot of feedback about managing the temperature initially in the stint. If you think that the tyre is like a blanket, you know, around this pressure, just the tyre itself. So the thinner the tyre is, as you wear it away, the less heat that's in it internally. So even from the beginning of a stint to the end of a stint, you know, in the first laps when the tyre is quite thick, the temperature will be different to the final laps where the tyre is quite thin. So the whole way through the race, the situation is evolving, and actually it's driver and engineer reaction to that decision that sometimes allows drivers to do these very long stints, or for the tyre to wear out really quickly.
And before moving on, how quickly up to the race can you as a team change these tyre pressures?
So right up until sort of just before the grid, like on the grid, teams can adjust the tyre pressures. Just to come back to Lawrence's point, that there is a minimum pressure that Pirelli will check. I think that's checked 3 minutes before the lights out. So Pirelli are always checking that you've achieved that minimum. But teams can make adjustments you know, above that minimum right up until a few minutes before they're on the grid, so they can react live to track temperatures or rain conditions, wherever it might be.
Well, we are going to do an entire episode on tires coming up, but thank you to both of you for answering that.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Moving on to the next voice note. Woo woo.
Hi, it's Ant from Bristol here. Big F1 fan. Have been for years. But one of the things I've never really understood is when they talk about mechanical grip and what the difference is really between mechanical grip and the downforce provided by aerodynamics. So if you can help, that'd be great. Thanks.
Excellent question from Ant. Lawrence, let's come to you first. Can you help demystify mechanical grip?
So this was actually one of the first things that I didn't know when I was getting into Formula One. I didn't understand. I heard it mentioned on commentary. And back in the day, Google wasn't around so much. I was looking in F1 books in libraries and stuff to find out. But from what I understand, grip, let's just deal with grip first. I think that's essentially the amount of traction that a car has when it's out on track. So the more grip you have, the faster you can go through a corner because you'll be more stable through the corner. And that means that ultimately the faster you'll be. So mechanical grip is focused on the vertical load of the car. So that's essentially the weight of the chassis. The more efficient you've got that contact between the tires and the asphalt, ultimately is down to how good your suspension is. And that means you've got more mechanical grip. So I think you'll hear us talking about this kind of thing at, say, Monaco, Hungary. They're kind of your tighter, twistier circuits because you've got lots of slow speed corners. So that's the difference, I think, between mechanical grip and, say, aero grip, which is the body work on the car.
Yeah, exactly. So the one thing just to sort of add a little bit, what Lauren said is exactly right. And I agree, you know, if a car is stationary, it will have mechanical grip because that is the weight on the car. The aerodynamic grip that we get from the wings, the front wing, the rear wing, whatever, that changes with speed. So the faster a car is going, the more downforce those wings provide. And that's why the aerodynamic grip changes in high speed corners. And that's why, like Lauren said, at places like Monaco, where there's not so much high speed, the mechanical grip becomes much, much more important. So at all points, you're trying to balance this relationship between the mechanical grip, which is effectively the weight that each tyre is taking, and therefore how it transfers that into speed, along with the aero grip, which is the load that's been put on each tyre by the aero components. So there's like a lot going on to balance there.
I've learned something there. Thank you both. And let's stay with tyres, because Gonzalo Gomez Nava asks, why do they cover the tyres before the race? Thank you for your question, Gonzalo. And I'm assuming, Lawrence, that Gonzalo means tyre blankets. So can we get you, Lawrence, to tell us what tyre blankets are and why the teams use them?
Yeah, so I'm guessing Gonzalo's talking about tyre blankets as well. So they're pieces of fabric that wrap around the tyres. They've got heating elements inside them, and that just helps the whole tyre keep an even constant temperature, which I think at the moment, Bernie, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is around 70 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
And that just means that they keep them at a constant temperature. So when the drivers head out of the garage or they leave the grid at the start of the race, the tyres are at the optimum temperature, because that gives them the best chance of keeping them in the ideal operating window when they're out on track. So you'll often hear the drivers going like the tyres have gone off, or they're struggling to get temperature into the tyres. What you ideally want is to go out with that ideal temperature in the tyres and then maintain that temperature. So when you say do your push lap in qualifying and you're going for that pole position time, you've got the tyres at the right temperature. So that's why you need those tyre blankets, why you see them, the mechanics normally just ripping them off just before they pull away on the grid or just before they pull out of the garages is because they want to leave them on for as long as possible to keep every degree of heat, I guess, in the tire for as long as possible.
And it turns out it's not just tires that they can keep warm. Lewis Hamilton at one point in time used one of those as like a body warmer at a cold preseason test. Were any of you there to see that?
No, I didn't see that. And I'm gutted because I would have definitely borrowed one and used one of those because they're kind of like an electric blanket, right? Like in bed in the winters, that's what the kind of thing you'd use. So yeah, similar. Good idea, Lewis.
I was going to say, one of the things that I remember at one of my first races is seeing the tires all lined up, whether it was Ferrari and it was an Italian, the lefts and the rights and the tire blankets. That was a big surprise to me at one of my first F1 races. I understand why now. But it was really neat. And I always took a photo at every of my races. I did, a big, as we all do on social, post what our experience was. And I always have a tire photo in that mix because I always thought it was so fascinating. They were so decorative, pretty with Italian writing on it or whatever the lefts and the rights were. I just thought that was, it's really interesting how much of tires are precious cargo, if you will, for these teams.
So we're learning that Katie likes voice notes and tyres from Formula One. That's what we're getting from this.
Can I just add something? One of the things that's interesting going forward, and the teams or the FIA are starting to push towards not having those tyre blankets. So there's a bit of a push that we start to produce tyres, or Pirelli start to produce tyres that don't need the blankets, so therefore you're not carrying the blankets with you everywhere, but the tyre's starting off from cold. So there's a lot of work between Pirelli, the FIA and the teams to see if they can make that happen.
And what's the intent of that? Why is that beneficial?
Well, so there's a few things. If you think of from an environmental point of view, you're not putting this heat through all of the tyres all of the time. Certain things as well, like for example, when you heat a tyre, you actually change a little bit the compound of that tyre. So if you think if you've got like just any bit of like material or a rubber or a racer or whatever, when you heat it, it changes a little bit. So every time you heat the tyre, you change it a little bit. So let's say you heat the wets in Imola, but you don't use them for the next 7 races. Well, by 7 races time, that tyre compound will be a little bit different. So not heating it has benefits for carrying the tyres across events. So they're trying to get to this point where environmentally, we're doing the best we possibly can for the tyres, and it's a lot less overhead. So we spend a lot of time from an engineering point of view looking outside and thinking, is it going to rain today? Is there a chance of it being wet? Do we need to turn on the wet tyres and they need to be on for, an hour before we use them, that type of thing. So there's a lot of work in terms of making sure particularly inters and wets are ready for the session, and you get rid of a lot of that and the energy needs of it as well without having the blankets. But like Lawrence alluded to, there's a lot of concern from drivers in particular that the dry tyres, when you go out in a qualifying lap, won't be ready for lap one because you're still warming up the tyres. So it's a real big topic point at the moment.
Well, to say then they'd have to maybe put a formation lap before qualifying to warm up the tyres. And that point, it's another minutes added to sessions.
Exactly. And it's the cost of running an F1 car for an hour or another lap versus heating the tyres for an hour or 2 hours. So it's going to be interesting to see by the end of the year or next year where we get to with that.
I guess you could say heated tyre blankets are a hot topic, guys.
Hey.
There we go. You sounded quite disappointed with me there, so I'll move on quite quickly. Final very brief one on tyres, Lawrence, is from Kayla Cupilo. She asks, a great question. One of my favourites so far. Why do F1 cars have 4 tyres? Lawrence, you can give us a fairly brief answer on this one, can't you?
I can keep it quite short. The rules say you have to have 4 tyres. That's just what the rules say. There was, back in the day, they did have one car, I think Tyrrell it was, who did a 6-wheeler where they had 4 front tyres and then 2 at the rear. And that just gave them better grip into the corners. So it's a less understeery car. And I think Jody Scheckter won a race in that car, but then they were outlawed and the rules just state 4 wheels. That's what you've got.
I love that question. I think that's great.
It's a great question. And Lawrence, you mentioned digging into your F1 books. When I was a kid and got bought an F1 book by my dad, it had pictures of the legendary Tyrrell 6-wheeler. And I was like, oh, wow, it looks so cool. But alas, there will be no more return for the 6-wheeler anytime soon, sadly. Right, we're going to move from tyres to points. Katie, you've got a question from Ralph.
Ralph Rosario asks, why is the F1 points scoring system the way it is? 25 points for the winner down to 1 point for 10th.
So, the point scoring system's changed quite a lot over the years. Back in the day, I think up until around 2002, only the top six cars scored. Then they increased that to eight. The top eight scored, I think, around 2003. And then they changed it again 7 years later when the field had 24 cars and they allowed the top 10 to score. So over the years, a different number of points have been awarded to the winner, 9, 10, and now 25 for the winner. You got 25 down through to 1 for 10th place. And the idea is that you fight for position more because the gaps between the points are slightly bigger. So there's more, say, to fight for if you're in the midfield because there's more points available. And then if you're fighting further up the field, especially if you're going for the win, there's a 7-point gap between 25 and 18. So it's maybe worth taking a bit more of a risk to go from second to first just to get those extra couple of points. So at the moment, there's more reward, say, for the teams who are really fighting hard, because every team in Formula One's fighting hard. But back in the day, you didn't always used to get reward for that with points, where at least now half the grid can score points.
Bernie, one of the things that I'm curious about is, as a consumer of these races, the points is the most challenging thing for me to keep track of how does one equate to another? What does that mean by the tail end of a race? But you've been part of these teams before. How is there somebody on the team that's specific to points counting, and that is the person who makes sure that everyone on the team knows what happens if someone gets ahead of that one or if someone passes someone there? Because by the end of a race, people feel like they know, like, it's pretty adamant of who's where and what in the grid.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We don't necessarily have one person dedicated to it, but some of the team management will definitely have that more on their mind than others. And we've got loads of tools that help us. So we've, you know, the calculations going on in the background of our software, and it's fit to say it moving up a position, like what that does not only for the driver, but for the team championship position. So lots of those calculations are happening in software in the background and sort of reminding us of what's at stake at each point in the race. So yeah, it's easy calculations and that's just adding and subtracting, but there's a lot going on all the time during the race.
Right. Katie, we've got another question I was about to say your neck of the woods, Katie, but the USA is a famous...
my old neck of the woods of California, if you will. Kathy Fairbanks from Sacramento, California says, "Hi, I'm an American F1 fan." Thank you. "Predictably now a fan after Drive to Survive." We do know that there's a few Drive to Survivors in this mix. "I've been saying that this type of podcast was needed since I first started watching. There's so much that I don't understand, but I did love that Sprint podcast. Please keep this up."
Can we get Kathy on every week? I'm enjoying this question. This is excellent.
Yeah, we'll hang out with her more often. The question, though, to Lawrence is, what does it mean to set up the car on a race weekend, and why is that so important?
Okay, so Formula One teams obviously have one racing car that they take to every single race, but every single racetrack is different. So you've got high speed circuits like Monaco that have got a lot of more slower corners. You've got tracks like Monza and Spa, which are low downforce circuits. And with that in mind, the team can't just send the same car out at every circuit, because obviously it's not going to perform to its best of its ability. So they have to do what they call setting up the car. And that's just to try and get the right balance, fine tuning the car, maybe making some adjustments to, say, the ride height, maybe to how you run suspension, just so it suits how bumpy the track is. So you're always going to each circuit with a body of information. Drivers always complain that they spend so much time in the simulators before they go to a circuit, but that's just to gather a load of data so that the teams have something to work with when they get to the circuit, so that before they send the cars out on track, they've got what they describe as a setup. So they've made some tweaks to the car. They send them out, see if it correlates, and then they make further tweaks. So it's essentially trying to make the car as efficient as possible on the circuit that they're racing on, and that would depend on the corners, as I say, the number of straights, the compounds, the weather. So depending on all of those packages, that's how you kind of set the car up. That's kind of what they mean.
Bernie's car setup strikes me as something from your neck of the woods, from a strategist point of view. What does it mean to set the car up on a race weekend? Why is it so important?
Well, typically setup is sort of the responsibility of the race engineer and the performance engineer. So they're looking, like Lawrence described, for that driver, for that car, for that track, what is going to give the best lap time. You know, the ultimate goal is fastest lap time that you can get. So there's loads of little things. And, you know, the most obvious example to the outside world is when you see the cars with a really big
rear wing on it, and then you could see some cars with a really small rear wing. And that's an example of setup where they're changing the downforce setup, so it's an aero setup, but in order to have better or worse straight line speed, or to have better or worse performance in the corners. So it's that balance. Now that's what's really obvious, but you know, there's so many things that they can change under the bodywork of the car that we can't see. So, you know, how stiff is the suspension? How it's reacting to certain corners, how it's traveling over the bumps, you know, how, you know, sometimes see the cars that are really stiff and bouncing. So all of that comes from setup, and it's the compromise again that we talk about a lot between all of the different elements in order to get the quickest lap time out.
And then that setup, of course, that's the point of the practices, to identify what setup does work then for race day, so it is transferable throughout a weekend.
Exactly. And you'll often find that, you know, maybe there's two setups that you think might work well. So sometimes in like an FP1 session, they might test one setup in one car and one setup in another. And then at the end of FP1, compare the results for both between across both drivers and with the driver feedback, and then choose which direction the team is going to go in for the FP2 session. So that's why in the P1 sessions, you can often see one driver struggling or not, or, and you'll hear a lot of talk of, you know, converging on setup or choosing a different setup. It's because there's different compromises that can be made. So yeah, it's all about getting, and it depends a little bit on the track too. So for example, in Monaco, we all know Monaco's famous for being difficult to overtake, but you focus your setup on qualifying, because the qualifying lap's the most important thing, and actually the race lap's not that important. Whereas places like Barcelona, where it's easier to overtake, actually your race lap's really important. So your setup could change between high and low fuel, or different tyre compounds, for example. So depending on what you think your race is likely to look like, depends on where you focus that setup on.
And we should, before we move on from Cathy's question, Cathy might be our biggest fan, I think, Katie. Cathy sent us a lovely... Yeah, thanks, Cathy. Cathy sent us a lovely long email with loads of questions. I think we could have done an episode just on Cathy's questions. So, Cathy, we will definitely use some more of your questions in future episodes. Thank you very much for your questions. Right, we will leave it there for now. That is it for part one of this Quickfire Why episodes. We still have loads more questions to get through. Lawrence and Bernie, will you join me and Katie for another one of these very soon?
Absolutely.
Look forward to it.
Fantastic. Right, myself and Katie will be back next week with another Formula Y, and Lawrence and Bernie will join us again very soon for some more quick fire questions. This is Formula Y. Don't forget to check out our other official F1 podcasts, F1 Nation and F1 Beyond the Grid, for even more F1 listening. We will be back very soon. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.